October 19th, 1983 was a tragic, tragic day in Grenada and identified what many would consider to be the final day of the Grenada Revolution. This is episode 5, and for additional details, please visit GrenadaRevo.com. That's Grenada, R-E-V-O.com. And if you haven't already, I would suggest checking out episodes 1, 2, 3, and 4. If you have any comments, any feedback, any suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. Again, please visit GrenadaRevo.com and look for the contact page. I'm Debbie. Thank you for listening. For many, the Grenada Revolution came to an end on Wednesday, October 19th, 1983. In the preceding weeks, several New Jewel Movement members, NJM members, proposed that leadership of the party should now be a joint effort between Grenada's Prime Minister, Maurice Bishop, and Grenada's Deputy Prime Minister, Bernard Cord. Although initially in favor of the idea, Maurice Bishop began to voice his reservations and his concerns about the proposal, and this change of heart led to a series of events. Since Thursday, October 13th, Maurice Bishop, the Prime Minister of Grenada, has been placed and remains under house arrest at his home in Mount Weldale. And his home, in fact, is just a stone's throw away from his colleague, Deputy Prime Minister Bernard Cord. Jacqueline Kreft, who is the Minister of Education and someone with whom Bishop has a personal relationship, is also in the house with Bishop. She arrived on Monday, October 17th, with the knowledge that once she was in the home, she wouldn't be allowed to leave his home. So both Jacqueline Kreft and Maurice Bishop are technically both under house arrest. Bishop has also been accused of creating a false rumor. The rumor that he allegedly has created claims that Bernard Cord and his wife Phyllis are plotting to have him killed. Bishop denies this allegation. He says that rumor has nothing to do with him. Vincent Noel, a trade unionist and a Bishop supporter, is also under house arrest at his home in St. George's. He's been accused of conspiring with Maurice Bishop. Major Einstein Lewison, who is the former chief of staff for the People's Revolutionary Army, for the PRA, is under house arrest at his home in St. George's. He's been accused of dividing the army. He is also a supporter of Maurice Bishop. Einstein Lewison's brother, George Lewison, who, although no longer a part of the NJM leadership, has spent 3 days meeting with Bernard Cord in an effort to resolve some of the party's conflicts. George Lewison is arguably Maurice Bishop's staunchest supporter. He serves as Minister of Agriculture. He has also been placed under arrest. Cletus St. Paul, Bishop's personal security guard, his bodyguard, is imprisoned at Camp Fidon for his role in spreading the rumor about the plot to have Bishop killed. Although Cletus St. Paul initially denied Bishop's involvement in the rumor, he now says that Bishop, along with George Lewison, is the source of the false assassination rumor. Kenrick Graddix, Minister of Industry, is imprisoned at Richmond Hill Prison for leading a pro-Bishop demonstration. Unison Whiteman, who serves as Grenada's foreign minister, who was also one of the men who led the pro-bishop protest in St. George's the day before, he's actually gone into hiding to avoid arrest. Additionally, several of the People's Revolutionary Government cabinet ministers have submitted their resignation in response to Bishop's house arrest. They are Jacqueline Kraft, Minister of Education, Unison Whiteman, Minister of Foreign Affairs, George Lewison, Minister of Agriculture, Lydon Ramdani, Minister of Tourism, Norris Bain, Minister of Housing, and Merle Hodge, who is an educator within the Ministry of Education. Bernard Cord, Deputy Prime Minister, also holds the role of Minister of Finance. He has also submitted his resignation, but not in response to Bishop's house arrest, but more as a safety measure that he's taken in response to the way the rest of the nation has reacted toward him, no doubt in response to Bishop's house arrest. A mediator from Trinidad, Michael Owls, is in Grenada, and he's assisting with mediation efforts between the two factions. He's trying to come up with a resolution between Morris Bishop and the Central Committee and other members of the NJM. So he's there to help with conflict resolution. For the last few days, thousands of Grenadians have been demonstrating throughout the country, demanding Bishop's release. The atmosphere is tense. Grenadians are angry, and they want to see their leader, Morris Bishop. Journalists initially on the island covering these developments have been forced to leave, and those trying to make it in have been denied entry by NJM officials. A group of NJM members met with Bishop late Tuesday into the early hours of Wednesday morning in his home, and they've presented him with a 5-point proposal for his consideration. Bishop has promised that he will review and get back to them the following day, Wednesday, October 19th. Wednesday, October 19th, 1983, was slated to be a very hot day. And as early as 7 o'clock that morning, George Lewison arrives at Bishop's home in Mount Weldale, and he's there to review the proposal submitted by the Central Committee the night before. Because George Lewison is still under arrest, he has a PRA escort. He has a soldier with him. Lewison and Bishop meet for the best part of 2 hours as they go through the points of the Central Committee's proposal in the hopes of coming up with a response and hopefully a resolution to the turmoil that Grenada is experiencing. That is until the soldier who is escorting Lewison begins to get antsy, and he wants to leave, and he wants to leave immediately. It seems that he's received word that a huge crowd is heading in the direction of Mount Weldale. So the soldier repeatedly tells Lewison they need to leave, and he, George Lewison, is taken back to detention at the park in nearby St. Paul's. Meanwhile, scores of people, including school children, are arriving by bus into the town of St. George's. Soon, there are approximately 3,000 to 4,000 people in Market Square, and they continue to pour in. Roads are jammed with crowds. Waves and waves of school children are everywhere, making it more crowded than Carnival. In the town of Grenville, in the parish of St. Andrews, the northeast side of Grenada, businessman Lydon Ramdani, who also served as the Minister of Tourism, is doing whatever he can to organize more buses to the country's capital. Another businessman, Norris Bain, who also serves as Minister of Housing, is rallying support as best he can in St. George's for Morris Bishop. Grenadians have declared a national strike, and businesses everywhere are urged to close their doors. Unison Whiteman, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, actually comes out of hiding, and he is in Market Square in St. George's doing what he can to get a public address system to speak to the huge crowd that continues to grow. And Whiteman begins to address the crowd about the injustices to Maurice Bishop. And at some point in the sweltering heat, the crowd makes its way up the steep hill and heads in the direction of Mount Wildale. They shout as they go. They're chanting for their leader. We want Bishop, no Revo. And from various vantage points throughout St. George's, officers and other members of the army are in shock by the number of people in St. George's. And as the crowd's route to Bishop's home becomes clear, several of them spring into action. Back at Pearl's Airport, the island's only airport, located in the northeast, is closed until further notice. Flights coming into the island are returned mid-flight. The military forces status is upgraded from alert to alarm. Even the staff at the state-controlled Radio Free Grenada station turn off the transmitter to ensure that no rogue broadcasts can be made. The crowd, along with trucks and cars, winds its way up Lucas Street. And by 9:30 that morning, with a bare-backed Unison Whiteman taking the lead, approximately 3,000 to 4,000 people arrive at the gates of Mount Wildale. School children push their way to the front, chanting, "We want Bishop, no school, no Bishop, no Revo." The security unit that's assigned to Mount Wildale, they attempt to hold back the crowd by forming a human chain against the gate leading to the access road to Bishop and Cora's house. And then Leon Cornwall, who is now in charge of the army, attempts to address the crowd. "Maurice Bishop has betrayed the masses." The demonstrators boo him, and he finally has to give up on his speech. The crowd surges forward, and as they do that, the gate to the entrance of the compound begins to buckle against their weight. And so at the orders of Ewart Lane, a couple of APCs, armored personnel carriers, arrive from nearby Fort Frederick at Mount Wildale shortly before 10 a.m. that morning. And in an effort to scare the crowd, soldiers then begin to fire shots up into the air. This stuns the crowd, and people immediately run for cover. And the gunfire continues off and on for several minutes. But it isn't long before the crowd sees this for what it is, and they realize that this is just a scare tactic. It isn't long before they continue to surge forward again towards Bishop's house. Meanwhile, the soldiers that are there stand by because they have been given strict orders not to fire on the crowd. Somewhere towards the front of the crowd, in front of Bishop's official residence, a 19-year-old student by the name of Thompson Cador from Grenada Boys Secondary School, GBSS, and a few of his friends, they come up with a plan to rescue Bishop. And somehow they make their way through the gate so they could get to the back of Bishop's house. At some point, they're successful, and Maurice Bishop and Jacqueline Kreft are carried out of Bishop's home. When the crowd sees him, they are ecstatic, and there are cheers, and there are chants. The crowd, along with a released, though visibly exhausted bishop, then leave the Mount Weldale compound, and then they head back down Upper Lucas Street. They reverse their route. By now, it's 10:30 in the morning, and with Bishop free and carried away by his supporters, they head into town. Meanwhile, Ewart Lane and the armored personnel carriers immediately return to Fort Frederick, and they activate the combat alarm. It isn't long after this that members of the Central Committee begin to assemble at nearby Fort Frederick. There are attempts to secure classified documents, and they begin to hatch a plan. They're trying to figure out what to do. Remember, at this point, they thought they were going to be meeting with Bishop, who's going to come up with a response to the proposal they presented the night before. Instead, Bishop has been released from house arrest by the people of Grenada. The crowd is cheering. Thousands of people are jubilant as they spread across the entire road and they head downhill on Lucas Street. There's a massive flow of people, cars, and trucks, and they head for Market Square. Bishop, inside of a Daihatsu truck, is surrounded by his supporters. Thousands of Grenadians line the streets, ecstatic, to finally get a glimpse of their prime minister. In fact, many, if not the majority of people towards the front of the crowd, arrive at Market Square in anticipation of finally hearing Morris Bishop speak. Their wait would be in vain. Along the way, the course of the procession is changed when the vehicle that Bishop is riding in makes a left turn at Church Street. Instead of continuing straight ahead, the crowd that's actually surrounding Bishop makes a beeline and heads in the direction of Fort Rupert. The thousands of people that are behind Bishop's car pass the word, "We're going to Fort Rupert." Some people would later leave Market Square, actually, to join the others at Fort Rupert, while others simply remained at Market Square, sort of holding some sort of vigil. There's lots of speculation surrounding this fateful decision to go to Fort Rupert instead of Market Square. Why would Bishop do that? And the theories are numerous. One theory is that Bishop was tired and he needed medical attention. The hospital in Grenada was located adjacent to the fort. Perhaps that was the reason for the change. Another theory is that by going to the fort, Bishop would have access to the army transmitter, and this would give him a chance to speak with the crowd. Another thought is that by going to the fort, Bishop would be able to arm his followers with weapons. Remember, Bishop was still commander-in-chief, and perhaps the thought was that he might be able to influence the doubters in the military, influence them not to support Cord, not to support his rivals, because it is fair to say that the majority of the military at this point was behind Bernard Cord. Bishop was viewed as a traitor to the revolution. So one theory is perhaps by going to the fort, he would be able to gain access to arms and military. And by doing that, he would be depriving Cord of the same. Another theory is that by going to Fort Rupert, he was going to be secure. Fort Rupert has a dominating position, and there's only one narrow approach into the fort. And perhaps the thought is that Bishop would be safe for a while. He would have access to food, water, ammunition, and he would have time to recover, time to think, time to organize, time to mobilize assistance. So a lot of theories as to possibly why the decision was made to go to Fort Rupert instead of heading to Market Square. So after turning left onto Church Street, there's a long procession of the crowd going towards Fort Rupert. So they pass by the offices of the Grenadian lawyers. They pass by the Anglican Church, even the headquarters of the representative of the British High Commission, John Kelly. There's records of the crowd going past his office. So Fort Rupert is located approximately 100 meters above sea level in Grenada's capital. It was built in the 1700s, and the fort was actually originally named Fort Royal. Then it became known as Fort George, and then renamed Fort Rupert by the NJM. And Rupert is in honor of Maurice Bishop's slain father, Rupert Bishop. The exterior of the fort is actually visible from all over St. George's. So it's surrounded by the bay, and as mentioned, the General Hospital. And outside the fort walls is a steep hill area with bushes and boulders that are located about 50 feet above the ground. Within the fort, the architectural principle of the buildings consists of four ascending squares. And each square, so think of each building as a square, and each square strategically looks over another square, almost like a stepping stone. And these buildings are connected by stone steps. And there are also a series of tunnels, of narrow tunnels, that run beneath. In 1983, Fort Rupert contained offices, barracks, prison cells. There was a canteen and an armory. The only entrance to the fort was a steep incline leading to a parking lot in the lower level area. The first level upon entering the fort via the narrow access road included a two-story building with rooms identified as the ops room and other sensitive areas, including a communications room, an engineering room, and a combat room. And all of this looked over a large courtyard. In 1983, Fort Rupert served primarily as the administration army post. Fort Frederick, where the Central Committee was assembled, was the full-fledged army post. So at Fort Rupert, there would be approximately 60 military personnel. And because of the fort's position, the soldiers that were there would certainly have seen a freed bishop and the massive crowd heading in their direction. So it would not have been a total surprise. They would have had an estimated 15 minutes from seeing the crowd before the crowd actually arrived at the fort. It's estimated that the main portion of the crowd arrived at Fort Rupert around 11 a.m. that morning. And on Wednesday, October the 19th was a Wednesday, several people were already at work at Fort Rupert. And without a doubt, armed soldiers would have been stationed at the fort's narrow entrance. So when Bishop arrives at the fort, there is some controversy as to whether or not the soldiers that were there were disarmed or whether Bishop told them to put down their weapons. But despite the controversy, the soldiers that were based at Fort Rupert did not attack, nor did they fire on the approaching crowd. Maurice Bishop, as commander-in-chief of the army, was certainly allowed on the fort. The rest of his followers, however, the crowd, did not have permission to be on the fort. Initially, the Fort Rupert officials stopped Bishop and the others from entering, as they should. So Bishop gets out of his car and he walks towards the soldiers at the entrance of Fort Rupert, and he wants to get their assurance that they are not going to open fire on the crowd. There's some negotiation, and it isn't completely clear if the soldiers were disarmed or if they just held onto their weapons and didn't shoot and didn't fire. But nevertheless, the crowd funnels its way through the small and narrow access road into the parking lot of Fort Rupert. Thousands of people. Well, at least hundreds of people. Because I'm not quite sure if thousands of people could physically fit inside Fort Rupert. Either way, people were jammed into the parking lot. And then once the parking lot was filled, they jammed the balcony on the first level of that first building. And as more and more people pour into Fort Rupert, Bishop and several people occupy the ops room that's located on the second floor of the first building. And immediately outside, there's a balcony that runs the length of the building, and that was packed with hundreds of people. So the parking lot is packed with people. The balcony around the exterior of the building is packed with people. The ops room is described as a room filled with highly, highly sensitive and secret documents. There would have been charts, maps, the entire coding system of the army inside of the ops room. The sight of everyday civilians in a room with such sensitive information, much less the fort itself, had to have shocked members of the military. However, no effort of force was made by the military to prevent access. Chris Stroud would have been the person in charge, a 26-year-old gentleman in charge of the fort at that time. He would have been in charge, but it's not quite clear where he was during the time period when everybody was entering the fort. And so for the next 2 hours, there is a flow of people going in and out of the ops room. Meanwhile, Morris Bishop and his colleague Unison Whiteman begin the process of writing a speech that Bishop is going to read from to address to the crowd, to the masses. So keep in mind, although there are several hundred people at Fort Rupert, the majority of the demonstrators are actually assembled at Market Square. The beginning of the day, the crowd starts at Market Square. They proceed to Mount Weldale. They free Bishop. They reverse their route. So the majority of the crowd at the front heads to Market Square because they believe that's where Bishop is going to be. But midway of that crowd where Bishop is inside of the truck, they detour. They make a left turn and head to Fort Rupert. The people who are behind Bishop realize this and follow him to the fort. But the majority of the people are at Market Square. For those who are at Market Square, by now they realize that Bishop is actually at Fort Rupert. But the word is that he is going to talk to them from there, either via transmitter or whatever sort of connection is made. So people are waiting for him at Market Square, in addition to the hundreds of people that are crowded into Fort Rupert. So keep in mind that this is a hot day, and with the sun blazing down in the middle of the day, because we're heading up to noon, even for Grenadians, a trek uphill to the fort area would have been exhausting. So it made sense for the majority of them to wait at Market Square. And had they really undertaken that journey for everyone to head to Fort Rupert, there would have been a human traffic jam of immeasurable proportions. So again, most of the crowd is waiting anxiously to hear from Bishop at Market Square. So there's a public address system is established, and it said that the sounds of Bob Marley's Get Up, Stand Up is playing in the background as they wait for Morris Bishop to speak to them. Meanwhile, back at the fort, at Fort Rupert, Peter Thomas, who is an immigration officer and is part of the crowd, he has briefly left Fort Rupert to go to the immigration office, which is next door to the fire station. And if you know Grenada, you realize the fire station is just minutes away from the fort. And the reason he has gone to the immigration office, next door to the fire station, is that Morris Bishop has personally asked him to complete three tasks. So the three tasks that Bishop gives to Peter Thomas are as follows. Task number one is that he needs to pick up a small arsenal of weapons that he knows are stashed at the immigration office. His second task is that Bishop gives him a list of names, and he tells him to go to the telephone office to ensure that certain phone lines should remain open and to disconnect others. So, for example, phone lines that Bishop wants to make sure are open are those to the respected journalist Alistair Hughes. He wants to make sure that word of what has happened makes its way out to the media. On the other hand, he wants to make sure the phone line to Bernard Cord is disconnected. And his third task is to establish a phone line from Fort Rupert and a PA system guaranteeing Bishop contact to the outside world and those in the vicinity. So with the help of three engineers, Peter Thomas accomplishes this. And it doesn't take him very long to do this, because Peter Thomas, it says, returns to Fort Rupert within 15-20 minutes. He has the weapons, the AK-47s and submachine guns, and he hooks up a line to the radio-free Grenada transmitter, giving Bishop the capability to communicate via telephone to his fellow Grenadians. Now, we're not sure how effective that would have been, because you may remember that radio-free Grenada actually turned off the transmitter prior to Bishop being freed from Mount Weldale. The Central Committee was scheduled to meet with Bishop at 10 a.m. on Wednesday. Remember, again, the plan was for Bishop to give them his response to the six-point proposal given to Bishop the night before. They never imagined the crowd would get to Bishop before they did. We can only imagine the meetings and the discussions that are taking place during this chain of events. The Central Committee had to have been panicking. Fort Rupert was overrun with civilians. Soldiers had supposedly been disarmed. What if Bishop was planning an attack on Fort Frederick? They had lost control, and they needed to retake Fort Rupert. Fort Frederick is a few miles away in St. George's, where the Central Committee is assembled. Fort Rupert is the fort where Bishop and his supporters are currently located. There is a contentious issue that concerns telephone conversations. So apparently Vincent Noel and Unison Whiteman, colleagues and supporters of Morris Bishop at Fort Rupert, were having telephone conversations with the people at Fort Frederick, the Central Committee. The details of those phone calls are not quite clear. There's also another controversy, and it surrounds the allegations that at this time the Central Committee was strategizing, and subsequently they made the decision to retake Fort Rupert and to kill Bishop with his close supporters in the fighting. The Central Committee members deny that this was ever part of their strategy. By 12:25 that afternoon, Ewart Lane makes the decision to dispatch three armored personnel carriers to Fort Rupert. And according to him, he was acting alone in his capacity as the operational commander of the army. He says that his goal was to capture the fort, meaning Fort Rupert, and restore order with minimal force. Ewart Lane would later go on to say, quote, "I remember sitting there, watching those units leave. Nowhere could I imagine that within the next hour, the greatest tragedy in the history of Grenada would occur," end quote. The convoy of vehicles, the APCs, leave Fort Frederick, and they head down Lucas Street, turning left onto Church Street, just as Bishop and his supporters had done a few hours before. Leading the first APC is Conrad Connie Myers. The second APC is led by Callistus Abdullah Bernard, and you may recognize that name. That's the name of the soldier who took over the guarding of Morris Bishop's home at Mount Weldale. He was brought over from Grenada's sister island of Carriacou. And then the third APC is led by 2nd Lieutenant Rayburn Nelson. So the troops are in full combat gear. They're carrying machine guns, and they were riding visibly on each of the armored vehicles. Behind the convoy of the APCs is a truck filled with additional soldiers, additional army soldiers. Onlookers see the trucks coming through the streets, and they make way for the vehicles as they roar through St. George's. Many people believed that the APCs were not there to attack, but were being sent to help Bishop. So it seems that the vehicles were never viewed as a threat. And as the armored vehicles approach Fort Rupert, the soldiers dismount and they walk up the incline towards the parking lot and the first level building, which again, parking lot is crowded. The first level building balcony is also crowded. Meanwhile, Don Rojas, Bishop's press secretary, was also on a mission. He was tasked with contacting external media. At this time, as the APCs are heading to Fort Rupert, he, Don Rojas, is at the telephone exchange on the Carenage. And on behalf of Morris Bishop, he needs to make sure that he communicates 4 points to the outside world. The first point that he wants to communicate is that the Grenadians have the capacity to solve their own problems. Secondly, he wants to dispel any rumors that the Cubans are involved in the crisis of what's going on. The third point is that he's calling on Grenadians that live outside of Grenada, i.e. Grenadians living in New York, in London, and Toronto primarily, and in an effort to get them to support the revolution and express their solidarity. And his final point is to call on the working class organizations and the trade unions throughout the Caribbean to make statements of solidarity. He wants to make sure that they know what's going on and that everyone voices their support for Bishop. Don Rojas spends the next 30 to 45 minutes or so, and he's making calls from the telephone exchange to several international news and media agencies. And he's successful, and he manages to communicate with the Caribbean news agency. He even gets to telex the ambassador to the UN, Caldwell Taylor, who's at the UN mission in New York. However, midway through these transmittals, Don Rojas hears gunfire. George Lewison, Minister of Agriculture, who is actually now a prisoner at nearby Richmond Hill Prison, hears an explosion. Reporter Alistair Hughes, who is waiting at Market Square along with thousands of people, hears two powerful explosions coming from the direction of Fort Rupert. And these explosions are immediately followed by automatic gunfire. It's a few minutes after 1 in the afternoon, and all hell has broken loose at Fort Rupert. The first APC vehicle, located at the top of the parking lot, swivels its turret from left to right and begins showering the crowd and the building in its path. A soldier is yelling and telling his fellow soldiers to concentrate fire on the first building. And the first explosion from the APC blows a hole in the front and the back walls of the ops room, while simultaneously the room is showered with bullets from the ground and from behind and from the level above. Bishop and the entourage in the ops room drop to the floor for cover. It's chaos, pandemonium. "My God," Bishop cries, "they've turned the guns onto the people." Gemma Belmar, who's a student in the ops room, is hit in the head by a bullet. Vincent Noel, the trade unionist and Bishop's supporter, believed to be on the crowded balcony when the gunfire begins, he's shot in both legs. He would die later on. And the gunfire doesn't stop. It continues for the next 10 to 15 minutes. In the parking lot, people are running. Many of them are school children. Black smoke is rising from the fort as the building and several cars in the parking lot are hit by the explosions from the APCs. Soldiers carrying a rocket launcher fire low and hit a vehicle. People are running to leave the fort. Many leaping over the ramparts, including school children. Remember, they had led the march. Some down the incline back into town, and bodies could be seen falling off the fort. Hearing the gunfire and the pandemonium, the crowd in the market square turned their attention to the fort. Remember, the fort can be seen from just about every angle within the town of St. George's. And looking at the fort, they see plumes of black smoke rising. And initially, there's confusion about exactly what is happening. But as people are seen running from the fort, screaming and wounded, the unbelievable is realized. Don Rojas relays the sound of what he is hearing and seeing to the news agency with whom he's on the phone right now. The smoke and the fire at the fort and the people scattering, he explains and describes it all in horror. And then when he looks again, he sees soldiers heading towards his location. And so he immediately slips away and he goes into hiding. Opinions differ as to who began shooting first. Callistus Abdullah Bernard, who was leading the 2nd APC, he says armed civilians fired the first shots from the building within the fort, killing all of the soldiers on top of the first armored vehicle. Witnesses in the ops room say that the explosion from one of the APCs was the first sound heard. Either way, the gunfire continues. Just repeated bursts of gunfire sounding in the courtyard. And this goes on for what seems like an eternity. And after several, too many minutes of gunfire, a man from within the ops room emerges and he's waving his white shirt in an act of surrender. And he yells out, "Comrades, we surrender. Please, would you please cease fire? We have a person dying here. There are a lot of injured people in here. Oh God, please, please stop." He gets a response. One of the soldiers shouts out, "Bring out the f***er and let the others come out with their hands in the air." And finally, after 15 minutes of constant fire, there is a hush. Three cars are on fire in the parking lot. People lay wounded, dying, or dead. Bodies are strewn across the fort and over the 50-foot drop at the battlements of the fort. Sylvia Belmar and Annie Bain, wife of Norris Bain, the Minister of Housing, are the first to exit the ops room. They're holding Sylvia's wounded daughter, Gemma, who has a gunshot wound and is bleeding from the head. Gemma died shortly after in their arms. And so, with hands raised, Morris Bishop and his colleague Unison Whiteman exit the ops room, and they're held at gunpoint in the parking lot as the rest of the people are allowed to leave the fort. Jackie Kraft, Norris Bain, businessman and minister of housing, Fitzroy Bain, the trade unionist, Mr. Evelyn Bratt Bullen, the insurance agent who was accused of leading the militia raid a few days before, Evelyn Maitland of Maitland Garage, and Keith Pumphead Haling, a Bishop supporter from the Market Import Board, they're singled out by soldiers as they file out of the ops room. And with hands over the back of their heads, they're taken to the parade ground, which is at the upper level of the fort. The reasoning behind who was picked out and who was left behind isn't clear. Colville Camus McBarnett would later say that direct orders were given by the Central Committee, who agreed that Comrade Bishop must be executed. He later testified, however, that this statement was given under torture. To this day, it is not clear who gave the direct order. Lester Redhead, a soldier, took charge of the organization, organizing the execution of Morris Bishop and his followers. With their hands over the backs of their heads, the group is told to face the wall behind the basketball hoop. Callistus Abdullah Bernard commanded the firing party. And so, at around 2 p.m. on Wednesday, October 19, 1983, a long burst of machine gun fire erupted for the final time at Fort Rupert, and silence fell over St. George's. Bishop and those who were lined up in front of the wall had surrendered. They were unarmed when they were shot. Prisoners at nearby Richmond Hill say that a white flare was shot above the fort, which they interpreted as a symbol to the Central Committee that their orders had been carried out. No accurate record exists of who was killed at Fort Rupert. No record. Eyewitness accounts put the number to be around 30 to 40 people. Hospital records show that more than 100 people were treated, of which 39 were serious. Many of the people who were treated went into hiding. Identified bodies at the fort included Andy Sebastian Alexander, Simon Alexander, Gemma Belmar, Eric Dumont, Avis Ferguson, Vincent Noel, Aline Romaine, Nelson Selfish Steele. The names of the PRA members, the soldiers that were killed, were Raphael Mason, Conrad Myers, Dorset Peters, Martin Simon, Franklin James, and Glenn Nathan. The victims who were killed execution style at Fort Rupert are Maurice Bishop, Fitzroy Bain, Norris Bain, Evelyn Bullen, Jacqueline Kraft, Keith Haling, Evelyn Maitland, and Unison Whiteman. The bodies of Morris Bishop and his executed ministers and supporters have never been located or positively identified. For show notes for this episode, visit GrenadaRevo.com/05. To learn more about the story of the Grenada Revolution, including additional episodes, a glossary, photos, timelines, articles, and more, visit GrenadaRevo.com. Thank you for listening.